program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Maureen McDonald for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next half hour, I'll be reading to you from the September 2020 Walter magazine. We begin with the cover article, Delicate, Declarative Art. Maya Freeland balances fragility and strength in her ephemeral work, by Liza Roberts. Maya Freeland's tissue paper sculptures are abstract, a confluence of kaleidoscopic color and organic shape. They move with the breeze, the passing of a person, the opening of a door. They make powerful, lasting statements with impermanent, inexpensive materials. Most of all, they're inquisitive. What is art? They ask. What's it made of? Who gets to make it? Who decides? The work is about challenging norms, social norms, economic norms, and art norms, by turning tissue paper into a fine work of art, says Freeland. It's about the fragility of life and transformation, and the ability to see beauty in a lot of different things. Often made in collaboration with groups of people, her work celebrates the communal aspect, the ancestral heritage, the connection to quilt making in my family, and the African American tradition of making a way out of no way. This month, Freeland's massive water-stained tissue paper quilts, including pieces made by as many as 100 far-flung community collaborators, will hang from the walls and ceilings of Raleigh's Contemporary Art Museum, CAM, as part of the Durham artist's first solo museum exhibition in North Carolina. Even if the museum can't open for the public to view these works in person, the show will be installed and shared virtually, says CAM director Gab Smith. Freeland's fans around the country and the globe will be glad to hear it. At Miami Art Week last year, she was named one of five young artists to watch. In 2018, she installed massive, wafting tissue paper stalactites at the Smithsonian Arts and Industries Building in Washington, D.C. She's lived and worked in Madagascar, Eswatini, and Italy as part of the U.S. State Department's Art in Embassies program. She's collaborated with Google and Cadillac, and her work is in the collections of the Smithsonian National Museum of African American History and Culture, the University of Maryland, and the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, among others. Freeland's talent and expressive ability were apparent early on, and she comes by both naturally, as the daughter of two renowned artists and the great-granddaughter of another. Her mother, the jazz singer Nina Freeland, is a six-time Grammy Award nominee. Her father was revered architect Phil Freeland, the architect of record of the African American History and Culture Museum on the Mall in Washington, D.C. His own grandfather was Alan Freeland, a noted Impressionist painter whose work was celebrated during the Harlem Renaissance. Her namesake and godmother was the poet Maya Angelou, Auntie Maya, a close friend of Queen Mother Frances Pierce, Freeland's beloved grandmother. Angelou once described Freeland's work, which she bought for her own collection, as visualizing the truth about the vulnerability and power of the human being. Freeland was a precocious teenage talent at Williston Northampton School in Massachusetts, where she transferred to finish high school after 2 years at the Durham School of the Arts. By 2006, she was a graduate student at the School of the Museum of Fine Arts in Boston, living with her grandmother Pierce. It was there that she came upon a stack of multicolored tissue paper in the basement of the house. The paper had most likely been in the same spot for 50 years. Drips from a leaky pipe had mottled the stack over time, moving the color from piece to piece, turning the sheets into gossamer rainbows. Freeland was transfixed and soon consumed with turning the water-stained tissue paper into art and using water herself to mark and alter tissue paper, intent on making something out of nothing. That discovery, born out of her connection to her family, became her signature medium. Often, artists think they need to work with precious materials, says Alan Edmonds, founder and director of the Brandywine Workshop and Archives in Philadelphia, where Freeland completed a residency years ago. Her use of tissue paper to make art both sets her apart and connects her to ingenious forebears, says Edmonds. It's in the tradition of working with what is available to you and being even more creative because you've created a challenge for yourself. Making something out of nothing is part of the inspiration for the title of Freeland's exhibit at CAM, Greater Than or Equal To. Freeland also sees the title as an inquiry. As an artist, as a black person, as a female, I'm constantly raising this question to myself, she says. How is value of a person, a life, a work of art, determined, and who determines it? If we don't value lives, if we don't value making this world equal, then we end up having a situation where certain people's lives mean more than others. Her use of the mathematical symbol, greater than or equal to, is to remind folks that it's a constant question, an opportunity for you to be aware of your judgment and where you're placing your value. She knows where her revered grandmother Pierce would have placed that value. I think of a quote from my grandmother, which is that we come from a family of sharecroppers who never got their fair share, she says. Grandmother Pierce's grandchildren and every black person making the world a better place were our ancestors' wildest dreams. Freeland considers to have survived what it took to get here, and then slavery, and then segregation and racism. We're living within it, and we're still existing, and now we have a chance to thrive. Personally, Freeland says she's more than thriving. I've never felt prouder or better or more grateful that I took the leap, that all of my focus goes into making art and sharing it with the world. I feel like I'm just getting started. This article was edited for Time. Next up, a Q&A. Extra credit. 4 decades in financial services inform Maurice Smith's perspectives on challenge, stability, and opportunity for progress, by Andrea Rice. Maurice Smith puts his community first. As the CEO of Local Government Federal Credit Union, LGFCU, and Civic Federal Credit Union, Smith has witnessed tremendous growth and change in the area over the years, and weathered a few downturns as well. In August, Smith celebrated his 41st year in the credit union business. Smith got his start in Durham at the State Employees Credit Union. He's been recognized for his contributions to the industry, including the 2020 Herb Wegner Memorial Award for Outstanding Individual Achievement, presented by the National Credit Union Foundation, and the 2019 Pete Creer Lifetime Achievement Award, presented by the African American Credit Union Coalition, which also established the Maurice R. Smith Fund to offer scholarships for credit union personnel to enhance their careers. Born and bred in North Carolina, Smith hails from Southport, but has been in the Triangle since 1982. He's married with 2 adult children and is also a deacon at Wake Chapel Church. The Triangle is a melting pot of people from different cultures, perspectives, and backgrounds who've all come together to make this community what it is today, he says. That's what I found so gratifying about putting down roots here. We caught up with Smith to learn about his experiences and how he thinks credit unions can help pave the path toward recovery. Why do you call yourself a credit union geek? A credit union is owned by its members. We are cooperative. LGFCU serves local governments in North Carolina, 545 municipalities and 100 counties, including public-owned hospitals, airport authorities, fire departments, police officers, and libraries. Essentially, all levels of government that fall under state government are part of our field of membership. Local government has similar qualities to our credit union. In government, we elect leaders to represent us and take care of the business of governing our communities. For the credit union, the board of directors is elected by members who do the same. In government, every citizen has an equal vote and a voice in how their government operates. Here at the credit union, all members have an equal single vote. So what does that mean in times like these? In June, we learned we're officially in a recession. That creates all kinds of havoc for our communities, for the employment of our citizens, for the viability of our businesses. If you're a citizen of the Triangle, and times seem a little unnerving to you, you want to know that the institution with whom you trust your financial resources helps you make good decisions and understands who you are. We don't know how to better do that than by having a democratic system so that all members are represented in what we do. How is your credit union primed to recover from the recession? What informs us about our viability in a market like this and our prospects for the future is how we've performed in the past. I came into this business in 1979, so in the 4 decades I've been in the credit union business, this is my 5th recession. I've seen inverted yield curves. I've seen unemployment go up and down. I've seen crime rates as high as 18%. I've seen trade imbalances. I've seen everything the economy can throw our way, except I haven't seen a depression. In all of these economic cycles, the credit union model has done well. When the world seems a little uncertain, credit unions often grow faster because people are looking for safety. How is your credit union helping folks here in Wake County? When the recession began and the pandemic was wrapping up, the federal government came out and asked financial institutions to be more generous with our depositors, offering extensions on loans, forgiveness on fees, forbearances, and other arrangements. If a member says, "I think I'm going to have some trouble making my payments," then we can help them weather the storm. We haven't turned off our lending services, and we haven't increased or changed our underwriting guidelines to make it tougher to get a loan. We've not closed out any lines of credit because we're suspicious that somebody might not be creditworthy in the future. This inspires confidence in the community. Have you noticed more people defaulting on their mortgages or running up bigger lines of credit since the recession began? During the recession in 2008-09, many consumers had difficulty making their mortgage payments. This recession is different. Many of our members called up ahead of schedule and said, "I'm going to have difficulty in the next 30 to 60 days. May I get help now?" That was tremendous. It shows that people have learned the lesson from the last recession. We think that's going to shorten the recovery period because we've learned to be smarter about how we help our members, offering financial counseling, planning services, and consulting. but I like to believe it appears that the consumers are much smarter this time around. That's very encouraging to me. In a recent blog, you wrote, "The lesson your credit union learns from protest is that social unrest is an opportunity for us to meet a real need for productive change." Could you elaborate on that? You can look at protests from a constitutional perspective. We as citizens have a right to seek redress from our government and have our voices heard. Since we serve a local government, they enforce and protect those rights. The protests happening here in our community and around the world are opportunity for dialogue. Sooner or later, the protests will cease and the dialogue will ramp up. I'm hopeful that we are seeing real solutions come to bear. Civic is a financial institution. We're trained to think about financial services and products first. But with social unrest and protests, we think, what products do we have that can make a difference? The underpinning for much of that is access to fair, affordable financial services so that all communities can become more economically successful. I believe we can make a difference there. Have you noticed any similarities between your work at Civic and your role as a deacon? There are remarkable similarities. The biblical definition of a deacon is to be a servant. We're called to help people source the basic necessities for living, safe housing, food security, and economic opportunities. Community service begins with a servant's heart to be supportive to others. This commitment arises no matter how one defines their role. This is the underlying thinking of Civic. The very notion of cooperative credit is built on the ideals of civic responsibilities. Members of Civic are not mere customers. They have an equity and a philosophical stake in the institution. This is an important awareness for community growth. Members are right to believe that Civic's main motivation for service is to advance the welfare of the community. It's this interconnection that makes us a community in the first place. And in culture, All Access Arts, How Raleigh's Cultural Scene is Welcoming People of All Abilities, by Andrea Rice. As the Americans with Disabilities Act, ADA, celebrates its 30th anniversary this year, our art scene is gaining attention for both elevating the voices of artists with disabilities and making spaces more inclusive to those who live with them. This summer, Raleigh was scheduled to host the John F. Kennedy Center's Leadership Exchange in Arts and Disability Conference, but it was rescheduled for 2021 due to the pandemic. We hope we'll be able to showcase some of Raleigh's Access achievements then, says Sarah Corin, Arts Grant Director for the City of Raleigh Parks, Recreation, and Cultural Resources. Around 1 in 4 adults in North Carolina has a visual, auditory, motor, or cognitive disability. And particularly in recent years, our arts institutions have recognized the talents and perspectives of artists with disabilities by showcasing work that offers a glimpse into disability life and culture. VAE hosted The Everyday in 2018, a multifaceted project that highlighted shared experiences of those who live with a disability, and The Full Light of Day in 2020, which featured artists with disabilities drawing awareness to their lived experience. At the Contemporary Art Museum, Justin LeBlanc's Probable Normal Hearing in 2019 told the story of the fashion designer's journey as a person with hearing loss. Last year, ArtSpace hosted Katie Shaw, a Richmond-based artist with multiple sclerosis, for a month-long residency followed by an exhibit. The residency will be offered again open to any artist that identifies as having a disability. The Raleigh Little Theater often casts actors with disabilities, including recent productions in 2019 of Pippin, featuring two actors that are blind, and The Curious Incident of the Dog in the Nighttime, starring an actor who has autism, as does the character he portrayed. Wiley Johnson, a painter who has autism spectrum disorder, has shown his work at multiple local exhibitions in recent years. I don't think artists should be recognized because they have autism spectrum disorder or any particular disability, Johnson says. I think that they should be recognized through acceptance in art, like other artists. This summer, three of Johnson's paintings were accepted into a juried art call for the Reawakening exhibit through September 27th at Durham's Golden Belt Campus for the Arts, and another at Pleiades Arts for Durham's 8th Annual Truth to Power Show in August. Corin says that the most important shift she's seen over the past 30 years is the recognition of different disability perspectives. A lot of that work is really cutting-edge and thought-provoking, she says. In addition to showcasing these artists, our cultural institutions have consciously incorporated more features and technologies that welcome audiences of all abilities. More organizations consistently offer a broader array of accommodations now, and they're much better publicized, Corin says. Advances in technology have been a game-changer, too, whether it's beam robots in museums that allow people with mobility issues to attend exhibitions with friends without leaving home, or phone apps that provide verbal wayfinding and artwork descriptions. Many of these advancements have been made possible and free through funding from the City of Raleigh Arts Commission and help from Arts Access, North Carolina's first and only nonprofit dedicated solely to making the arts accessible to people with disabilities. Founded in 1984, Arts Access works with arts professionals to improve how they engage with people with disabilities, including training on disability etiquette, language, and bias, promoting inclusion in classrooms and programs, making online communication accessible, and gearing outreach to different audiences. Around the Triangle and statewide, the nonprofit has been integral to making arts and culture offerings inclusive of children and adults with disabilities. Our philosophy is rooted in both education and advocacy, says Betsy Ludwig, its executive director. When people with disabilities share stories of barriers and discrimination in accessing arts and cultural opportunities, we work as allies to help them navigate those challenges. The Arts Commission and the United Arts Council of Raleigh and Wake County have also partnered on the Arts Learning Community for Universal Access, a peer cohort devoted to increasing skills and knowledge of arts organization staff. The program was designed to catalyze change, from increasing Braille materials to enhancing website accessibility. ArtSpace is one such example. Each of its galleries, classrooms, studios, and public areas is fully accessible. They have an on-site wheelchair, signage with Braille lettering, and exhibition brochures in Braille and large print, done through a partnership with the Governor Moorhead School for the Blind. And chroma glasses are available for visitors with color blindness. And recently, the gallery updated its tour program to include sensory materials for participants to feel and touch the materials used to make the work. Similarly, VAE aims to make all of its offering available and accessible to all who appreciate art, from audio tours to American Sign Language, ASL, interpretation, to making information available in Braille. VAE Executive Director Brandon Cordry says that the gallery makes a concerted effort to include people with disabilities, not only in its gallery space and artist programming, but also on its committees. We make sure we're holding that accessibility lens to all our work, even when it's not project-specific, says Cordry. The North Carolina Museum of Art leads tours for visitors with disabilities, including audio description, closed caption video resources, tactile tours, and ASL tours. Concurrently, Corin has observed an increase in consideration for creating welcoming experiences for people with autism spectrum disorder and other sensory sensitivities. There are a growing number of sensory-friendly performances by organizations like the North Carolina Symphony and special museum programs at places like Marbles Kids Museum and CAM Raleigh, Corin says. Raleigh Little Theater took a big plunge when it committed to doing a sensory-friendly performance for each of its family series shows. Corin says that while Raleigh has a lot to be proud of in terms of accessibility, there is still more work to be done. It's not a given that people with disabilities can enjoy all art events at every venue in town, she says. There are some aspects, like transportation, where the city could improve, says Alexandra MacArthur, a VAE board member and former chair of the board for the National Disability Institute. MacArthur, who uses a motorized wheelchair, says it's not always easy for folks to get downtown, where much of the city's art programming takes place. For Raleigh, being a leader in accessibility means continuing to foster the attitude of inclusivity and universal access of which our arts institutions are exemplary. As diversity, equity, and inclusion remain at the forefront of the discussion, Ludwig says that Arts Access hopes to keep disability a part of the conversation. Disability is an incredibly diverse experience, she says. There are still barriers and challenges, but good work is being done. This article was edited for Time. We've run out of time for today's episode of Walter Magazine. Be sure to tune in next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. I'm Maureen McDonnell for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Walter Magazine's available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, call us at 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. And thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.